Hey, I'm Vermont Edition producer Daniela Fierro. The podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. Parents, did your house feel eerily quiet this morning? School is back in session, and today we are kicking off a new Vermont Edition series, School Stories. Every Tuesday for the month of September, we'll focus on issues related to our schools. In part one of the series, we are discussing school consolidation and closures. Later in the hour, we'll talk with Vermont's former education secretary, as well as an advocate for smaller schools. They'll both share their perspectives on how school consolidation and closures can affect a community. But first, we are joined by Vermont Public's education reporter, Lola Dufour. She spent months looking into the story of Windham Elementary School in Windham County. She's here to tell us about the fight to save the school and what it says about the statewide debate over closing or consolidating schools and school districts in an effort to save taxpayers' money. Lola, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Michaela.
Yeah, we're glad you're here. So, Lola, tell us about Windham Elementary before it closed. How big was it and who went there?
Yeah, so the kids of Windham went there. It was a local public school. And it was really small. This was a K-6 school. And, you know, at its height, kind of when it was its largest, you had maybe about 30 kids there. We're talking about 15, 20 years ago. And when it closed, there were only 15 kids enrolled. So that's 15 kids across 7 different grades. It wasn't a one-room schoolhouse. It was like a 2-plus-room schoolhouse. Kids were typically kind of divided into, you know, 2 multi-age classrooms. There were usually 2 teachers, one of which was a teaching principal, plus a part-time administrative assistant. This is in southern Vermont, Windham County, a really rural part of the state, a really hilly part of the state. You know, geography also played into these debates. Mm. So that's Windham Elementary.
So how did this small rural school land on your radar?
Yeah, so it actually landed on my radar about 5 or 6 years ago. And this was back when I was covering Act 46, which was this big school district consolidation law. And Windham was really a key figure in kind of the leaders of Windham were kind of key figures in the opposition to this law. So this law really wanted small school districts to consolidate amongst themselves to kind of create larger governance structures, you know, more streamlined administrative structure so that there wasn't just like one little school district per town. Windham fought this tooth and nail. They did everything that they could to not merge with their neighbors. The time I actually visited Windham many, many, many years ago was when they were kind of contemplating taking this radical path, which they didn't end up doing, but, you know, which was like shutting down themselves and privatizing in order to keep local control. So That is when I first came to actually know Windham.
And when exactly did the calls for the school to close start gaining steam?
Yeah. So for years and years and years, you talk to anyone in Windham, there's been this debate about whether or not to close the school. And if anything, it actually picked up further steam after, you know, Act 46 was all said and done. So Windham actually did keep autonomous control of its tiny school. It was like sort of partially merged. But in terms of, you know, who was in charge of the K-6 school, it remained an entirely local affair. And the calls to close the school kind of only picked up steam or did pick up steam afterwards. And it was it was like an accumulation of a bunch of different things. A lot of, you know, it's my impression that earlier on, maybe it was more retirees, second homeowners that maybe didn't want the school open. But by the very end of it, you know, when I visited at town meeting in March, what I heard was basically a near unanimous chorus of parents saying, please shut down this school. And that was because of really staffing instability, in addition to kind of pre-existing concerns about whether or not you can actually offer sort of what we expect from a modern school in such a tiny, tiny setting. You know, one thing that I honestly wasn't able to pick apart that much in the story because there was so much going on was, you know, it felt like a lot of the parents who did want out of Wyndham Elementary wanted these things that schools have really picked up in the last kind of decade, right? They wanted after school. They wanted preschool. They wanted a hot lunch program, right? They wanted all of these things that are now kind of expected out of schools, but sort of once were not.
Mm. And at a small school like Wyndham Elementary, you're sort of trading those for the, you know, the potential benefits of you know, a very tight-knit small school community where, you know, the teacher or two knows every student intimately.
Go ahead. Well, no, I was going to say, I mean, that, no, you asked the question.
Well, those are the reasons why the school was being pushed to close. But I know from your article, Lola, and the stories you've told me about this community, that there were a lot of people who felt really strongly that this school should stay open, even if, you know, it was potentially going to be a large financial cost for residents. There were parents there who felt very, very strongly about sending their kids to this school. Can you tell us a little bit about what you heard from them?
Yeah. I talked to a lot of parents from, you know, a sort of prior time that felt like very strongly. Sorry, I had a little burp there. in support of this school. And, you know, for them, it was a small, intimate environment. They felt like their kids had received this mentorship by the educators that had been there and that, you know, really valued that intimacy. You know, there's also a farm about like a mile down the road, this privately owned hobby farm, and the kids would go there once a week. And, you know, supporter of the school often pointed to that as like, you know, what elementary school in Vermont like offers their students the ability to like go be at a farm, like not just every once in a while as a random field trip, but like as a regular part of the school. Isn't that kind of what every kid should have? Mm. And so, you know, and it's funny because, like, the things that people loved about the school were also the things that people hated about the school. Some people didn't like the intimacy. They thought it was claustrophobic and that their kids didn't have, you know, the peer groups that they needed. And as much as some people loved the farm, some people really didn't like the farm. And they kind of felt it like it was this community sort of, like, engaging in the pageantry of rural life without it being sort of a serious educational enterprise. And so, you know, it was kind of fascinating to watch people be so on opposing sides, even though they agreed sort of about the basic facts.
Right. Well, if you have thoughts about Wyndham Elementary's closure, give us a call at 800-639-2211. We're honing in on Wyndham right now as part of a broader conversation this hour on school consolidation and school closures. Let's go first to Kermit, who's in Wyndham. Kermit, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I was really disappointed that our 200-year-old elementary school closed. And I just wanted to share with the listeners how disappointing it was. But also, obviously, this is happening all over the country where there's a politicization of school boards. In our tiny little community, it didn't include the word woke, but it had the very familiar kind of archetypes involved. And so we had really what it came down to is a retirement, some older folks, boomers, who aren't from here, who never had kids here, never had grandkids here, don't particularly like the community, went after the school. And they put up all these bad faith arguments, and then they would just keep shifting the goalposts every time somebody met them at this debate. And it got very personal. Other people who are sort of high on grievances, who are not boomers, but might as well be, gained, you know, joined up with them. They went to the point of suing a really lovely family who had to move from their home because of mold. They had a brand new baby. Mm-hmm. And this group of people who were obsessed with closing the school sued this family because they voted after they moved.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. But it was dishonest, and they used a lot of dishonest ploys and tactics.
Kermit, thank you so much for calling in. We're speaking with Lola Dufour, a Vermont public education reporter who's been honing in on the story of Windham Elementary's closure. She has a story up on vermontpublic.org that you can check out. We can hear from our caller that this, you know, this debate did not end in a kumbaya moment with everybody, you know, shaking hands and agreeing that you know, the best possible outcome happened for the community. Lola, are there still these tensions that are similar to ones that you're hearing from this caller, Kermit? Did these keep coming up in your reporting?
Yeah. yeah, this has been an incredibly polarizing debate in Windham. It was really sad that, you know, this school, which was kind of like the only thing in town, right? Windham is a town of about 500. And like Kermit said, it has a lot of retirees, a lot of second homeowners. And there's nothing there except really the school. There's the meeting house, there's the town office, and there's the school. There are no restaurants, there are no bars, there's no general store, there's not a gas station. And so the only thing that was kind of left in town was also part of what was tearing the community apart. And, you know, Kermit is right. There were a lot of older people that didn't want the school, didn't see the point of their high taxes. But by the end of it, it was also a lot of parents who didn't want the school there. Mm. I think that is important to note.
Yeah. Lola, you brought up high taxes. Tell us about how you see Windham Elementary's story tying into the broader issues that we saw with Vermont's public education funding that played out this year during this past legislative session and beyond.
Right. I mean, you know, the very obvious. So in this highly charged moment when people are highly concerned about property taxes, we are going to see conversations about school consolidation pop up all over the place. We already are seeing them. And I think that, you know, a big part of the momentum towards closing in Windham came from that. I also think that Windham shows us that simply closing schools will not be a silver bullet to, like, you know, solving the problem of high property taxes.
Why not?
Because if you close a school, you still have to, like, pay for kids to go somewhere else, right? And sometimes when you close a school, you do save some money. Windham saved a little bit of money. But how you close, and then kind of the particularities of what school you closed, where they are, whether or not you go to choice or whether or not you consolidate with another school, all of that kind of changes the financial outcome. And so I think, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say that, like, closing schools probably does not need to be part of the conversation of how we get costs under control. But I think also anyone who, like, sells you this idea that the silver bullet to fixing Vermont's high property taxes is just closing a bunch of small schools, that's also not the case. It's actually really complicated and really nuanced, and it's going to depend based on the school. You know, that's obviously a big reason why we're talking about this.
Right.
And, you know, it's a big reason why there is such a desire to have these conversations.
Lola Dufour is Vermont Public's education reporter. You can find her story on Windham Elementary on vermontpublic.org. Lola, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Joining us now in studio is Rebecca Holcomb of Norwich. She served as Vermont's Secretary of Education from 2014 to 2018. And then in 2022, she was elected to Vermont's House of Representatives as a Democrat. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're so glad to have you. And right next to you in the studio is John Castle. He's the executive director of the Vermont Rural Education Collaborative. He consults with school districts wrestling with the fates of their small schools. He's also the former superintendent of North Country Supervisor Union. John, welcome.
And good afternoon. Welcome.
First, before we dive into other communities, other questions, I would love to hear your thoughts on what happened at Windham Elementary. That was the conversation we were just speaking about with Lola Dufour, who has a new article about it. John, let's start with you.
Sure. I guess the first thing I would say is that first and foremost, we need to celebrate our small rural community schools. I think there are a lot of amazing schools out there that are truly thriving and doing well. And certainly there are some that are, I think, persisting even with some really daunting challenges. Certainly if you are getting below 50 students in a school, I think there are a lot of challenges to overcome. And I certainly think in Windham's situation, I think my understanding is they were down to below 20 students. Mm-hmm. It's really sad, right, for a school community to lose its school, and school communities have to wrestle with that. I think they have to think about it from a programmatic standpoint as well as financial standpoint. And certainly those things can be compounded because of staffing and other challenges. But I think in Windham's case, you know, it was a tough decision, but certainly when you get to 15 students, that's a classroom. It's hard to justify it really persisting as a school.
Mm. And Representative Rebecca Holcomb.
I second what John said, but I want to start just by acknowledging how hard this is for that community.
Yeah.
It was obviously extremely painful for the community, of course, as a longtime educator. I think first and foremost of the children, and children know what is happening, and they know how divisive this has been. And I hope for healing for this community, because once you close your school, you lose that place where you come together as a community and you really plan for the future of your children and you talk about what kind of community you want to be, not today, but in 10 years. And that's a big loss. And so I think we have to start by acknowledging that. And I want to go back to something John said, because years ago we said there were more likely to be small schools in big districts. And I still believe that. And part of it is the scale issue. If you are going to be a small school, you need to have something that is going to envelope you and support you with all the things that a district and a school has to do. You may be 15 kids, but you still have to do everything the biggest school in the state does. And one of the things that John does, I don't think you are helping your schools struggle to stay alive. I think what you're trying to do is find ways to create scale where it's possible. So everybody has to do professional development. Instead of having every school do their own professional development, your region is looking at how can you work regionally to make sure kids, no matter how small their schools are, have access to teachers who have that kind of enveloping access to the best teaching possible.
Mm-hmm. Creating efficiencies.
Creating
That's something
efficiency.
We definitely want to talk about
scale.
In just a moment. But first, John, I wonder if you could kind of help us frame this conversation. We keep saying small schools. Mm-hmm. That means something different in Vermont than it does in
certainly.
Other places, certainly. And that definition has changed over the years here as well. How do you define a quote-unquote small school?
Yeah, I think it's important that we think about this within a Vermont context, because if you look at the vast majority of schools in the state, if you looked at them relative to national standards in terms of what's large and small, they would all be considered small pretty much.
Yeah.
So I think we have to look at our own context. I think one of the things that I've learned over the years as I've really become a student of rural communities and rural schools is that rural is relative, right? The reality is that almost all of Vermont is rural, and many of our schools are small. So I think, you know, there's almost more of a nuance that we need to consider, and that there's the idea of small schools and even micro schools. So again, I think once you're getting below 50 students in a school, it just really becomes increasingly more challenging, as Rebecca said, to provide all the depth and breadth of services and resources that a larger school has. And, you know, there are important things like our education quality standards, right, that set standards for how schools should operate. And it becomes more challenging to meet those standards in a smaller school.
Well, let's take some calls here. And listeners, if you have thoughts on this conversation about school consolidation and school closures, give us a call at 800-639-2211. We have Jeannie calling in from Lincoln. Jeannie, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thank you so much for taking my call and for having this conversation. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
A small town. I also don't always have the best cell service.
We're used to it.
Yes. I'm calling because I wanted to just say a few quick words about our experience here in Lincoln. So I'm the chair of the Lincoln School District Board, and I think some people on the call and others in the community will know a little bit about Lincoln's story, which was that we were part of a consolidated district, the Mount Abe Unified School District, and within a few years after that district was formed, three of the five elementary schools, there was a proposal to close. And a number of people in the community in Lincoln and throughout the district worked together to find alternatives to that. And for a variety of other reasons, there was additional merging proposal with another consolidated district in the area. We eventually decided that the best opportunity for Lincoln to remain, for the school to remain a vibrant part of our community, which it had been for so long, was to leave the district, which we did successfully. And even though it wasn't in any way our original intent, we were also made a supervisory union. So we are, in fact, a very small supervisory district, and we operate our own K-6, lovely Lincoln Community School, and we do tuition our high school students.
Thank you, Jeannie. I'm going to cut you off because we're hearing a little bit of feedback from your line, but Jeannie is calling in from Lincoln in Addison County, which Representative Holcomb has a number of supervisory districts, as Jeannie alluded to. What do you think about, I'm curious how much you know about what's going on in Addison County specifically, but about, you know, how some of these districts have adjusted 10 years in to the effects of Act 46, which was, you know, in large part had a goal of consolidating districts. That didn't quite happen in Addison County.
Well, it didn't. And I think it's hard to talk about Vermont by talking about any one district,
sure,
right? Because we're all, you know, there's a lot of complexity in the state. But
yeah.
I want to go back to the question of what small is. And John mentioned, I think you mentioned that 50 and below, it becomes hard to operate an elementary school. I actually think it's hard below 100 myself. And ideally, we're all in that situation. But the reality is, just like with the hospital system, in some of our rural communities, it's going to be hard for some of those rural hospitals to continue to provide high quality access if we don't think of them a little bit differently than we would UVM Medical Center. But we have to provide people with access to good public education. It's a constitutional obligation. So it's a little different, right? And I think we need to be careful. I think high school is different, and high school scale is everything. And when you look at tuitioning patterns, you look at public school choice, kids are using their feet to get to bigger systems because they want things. If you look at South Royalton and Bethel, which used to be two separate high schools and two separate middle schools, they could have one team. They didn't have enough kids to have a band, as one kid told me. They chose to merge their middle schools and their high schools into two new buildings that were bigger. They doubled what they could offer kids. Kids were elated because there were things they couldn't have done before that all of a sudden they had the opportunity to do. And that school's on fire, and they did this without raising their tax burden. So there are opportunities in terms of how we think. The difference was they really worked through very hard conversations as a community and set of communities to see a future together. What we didn't talk is about tuitioning, which is what Lincoln was mentioning. Mm-hmm. And we have to talk about that because even if you look at the recent data released by the Secretary of Education, the private schools to which we are sending public dollars are much smaller on average than the public school system. And we have different, we don't also hold them to the same standards or expectations. And if we are taking kids out of public schools to put them into even smaller schools, this goes back to what Lola was saying in the previous segment, where closing a school doesn't necessarily make the situation more affordable for that community. And it certainly doesn't for the entire state, because now we're spending more dollars to send kids to even more schools, including in the last data I saw, we were educating kids in London using tax dollars from Vermont. We were educating kids in Canada using tax dollars from Vermont. We were educating kids in prep schools that reject 90%+ of the kids who apply. That's cost. And if those kids were in Vermont schools, our schools would be bigger and they would be able to offer more robust offerings. So it's really hard to have this conversation about scale without talking about the leaky bucket that we're creating every time we say, hey, here's some tax dollars, take them anywhere you go. Because it might be cheaper for that one community, but it's making taxpayers everywhere else in the state pay more.
John, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on tuitioning. Do you also see it as a quote-unquote leaky bucket, as Representative Holcomb described?
Yeah, I think it's often very problematic that we're sending our resources out of state. Certainly, we're also allowing for small independent schools to siphon off public dollars that those students could be going to a public school. So I do think that's an issue. But I do think beyond the tuitioning situation, I think we need to continue to look at how do we support small schools that are going through challenges. And I think sometimes we tend to look at it solely as a deficit model, and I think we need to look at small schools often as an asset. There are a lot of resources that they have, a lot of positive outcomes they have, and certainly even the research out there supports that there isn't a relationship between size and outcomes for students. If anything, there is some research that supports students that come from poverty or students that are coming from marginalized backgrounds actually thrive and do better in smaller schools. So again, as I said from the very beginning, that we need to celebrate our small schools and look at them as assets, not necessarily look at them as deficits that need to be closed.
Well, the question seems to be not that the school, at least broadly, not that the school is a educating students poorly, but that it's educating students in a way that is way too expensive for the community to shoulder. Yes.
Well, here's a little bit of an analogy to consider. So if Vermont was a school, Vermont would be a small school, right? We would have limited resources, limited opportunities, lacking an economy of scale compared to our neighbors, like, let's say, New York or Massachusetts. And so I don't think any of us are looking at consolidating, right?
I think some people want to join Canada, but we won't get into that today.
but I think, yeah, there are some challenges with a lack of efficiencies, right? Yeah. Small schools do not have an economy of scale, but I do think we have recognized that even in legislation, that there's additional resources for rurality and sort of having that limited capacity. But we have to think about the trade-offs, right? Are we going to close a school and put students on a bus, right? Sometimes a 5-year-old or a 6-year-old in kindergarten or first grade, sending them off for an hour and 15, an hour and a half on a morning bus ride and the same thing in the afternoon, and disassociating their parents from their connection to their school. So I think the important thing is that each situation has to be looked at on its own. There are schools that will make the decision to close. Part of that is financial. Part of it is programmatic. And in this day and age, I would add a third variable. Well, actually, probably two more. Facilities is certainly, I think, a compelling issue that is prompting, I think, a number of schools to consider how do they sustain themselves. But I think staffing. I think that has become another pivotal issue that has challenged our small rural schools. And so I think those are areas that certainly my organization is focused on, trying to improve the teacher pipeline and pathways to licensure. But I do think when you look at both the finances, the program, and staffing issues, that's where it becomes precarious for a small school.
Mm. Representative, do you agree?
I think you've mentioned some of them. I mean, one of the reasons I sponsored the BOCES bill is because most states, and we were one of 7 or 8 states, it's boards of collaborative education services. There are certain things that school districts have to do. They are the safety net of last resort, and they have to take care of every child no matter who they are and what they need to be successful. And there are certain types of children who deserve to be given all the support and love we can give them, but they're complicated. And a school district, if you're a small district, and I've experienced this as a district principal, you might not see one of these children except once every 20 years. And you may not have on your staff the unique expertise that's needed to really crack the nut and help the school be successful with that child. And so other states use structures called boards of collaborative education services, which is, it's sort of like a super district for those services that are resource intense and lower frequency. So specialized services for students with extraordinary disabilities, certain kinds of professional development for example, some of the literacy work we're trying to roll out right now. We know what the recent science says. We need to be making sure every kid has access to a teacher who's been prepared on that. And these are ways to try to bring scale so that you can support. And it's really, again, it's not that different from the conversation we're having about our hospitals. Mm-hmm. We are now if not the most expensive state in terms of healthcare. We can't say, well, then we're just going to have to let rural hospitals close. And if we aren't planning it, if we aren't being intentional, we all know which hospitals are going to close first, and they may not be the right ones. What I worry about is because we aren't leading this, because we aren't managing this conversation, the schools that close are not going to be the schools where we could close them without harming kids and communities. Mm-hmm. And we need to be managing this to make sure every child has access to high quality, good public education. That's our obligation.
So when we talk specifically about recruiting and retaining teachers in these small schools, John, I'm wondering if you could give an example of a piece of advice that you have given when you are consulting with a small school that has come to you and says, you know, we really want to hire a teacher. We have been looking far and wide. We just can't find anyone to fill this role, but we really want this school to stay afloat. What do you say?
Well, I think that's why we are devoting a lot of time and energy in a very strong partnership right now with the Agency of Education, Department of Labor, and Vermont NEA to build out a Grow Your Own program, right? So that you have opportunities for a teacher pipeline where not only that individuals that are, say, the teacher of record working on a provisional or an emergency license, but for individuals working in schools such as paraeducators, instructional assistants that don't have a current pathway to licensure. They often don't have a bachelor's degree. And so if they're going to continue to earn and learn and work in the school, they need a non-traditional pathway. So I think that's a model that we are working to build out. We hope to have that launched by January. Also, I think a residency model is another model that we're looking at in terms of teacher development so that you can bring an intern into a school and have them work very intently in that school environment and really have that runway to be able to get off the ground as a teacher. So from an immediacy standpoint, there's no question. The data clearly supports we are hiring more and more individuals who are coming into the field of education through non-traditional pathways. And so those are individuals starting on emergency and provisional licenses. In order to support those people, we need robust mentoring programs and lots of wraparound support for those people to be most successful as teachers.
And I'd like to add one more voice to the conversation here as well. Pat Harvey. She's a select board member in the town of Rochester. Their middle and high school closed in 2018. Pat, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you.
We're so glad to have you. So now that the middle high school is closed in Rochester, where do students go now?
Well, we seem to be at a hub in the state. So unfortunately, our students don't all get dedicated to going to just one other school. They have choices of Middlebury, Randolph, Bethel, South Railton, and Woodstock, Otter Valley. and the students have kind of scattered around those the hub of all of those schools. So they just dissipated after they left sixth grade, and it does kind of take a little bit of the heart out of the town. The students themselves find new friends in other schools, and the sense of community for teenagers is not there anymore.
And I understand that your grandkids go to school in Middlebury. You pick them up many days of the week?
Yes, they do. Lots of traveling over a mountain. And they do spend about 45 minutes to an hour on a bus going both ways. And, of course, the sports is taxing on parents and grandparents as well.
Hmm. Do you notice any positive changes in their experience compared to your own child's, who I assume went to school in Rochester?
I would say so far, the quality of education and the opportunities that are at hand when they do go to the larger schools is a big benefit and outweighs the travel. The high school was alternating classes like algebra and geometry. The sciences were being altered. Every other year you would get certain sciences. So when they were graduating, some of them just didn't have the classes that others did in the larger school systems.
Hmm. And Pat, it's my understanding that the issue of school closure is what led you to run for select board in the first place. Could you tell us about that decision?
Yeah, when the merger was taking place, I'm also a real estate broker, so I knew that with the high school building being closed, that we were going to be looking at what to do with a 30,000+ square foot building. It had a very nice auditorium, a wood shop, an art room. There was a lot of opportunity there. So there was a committee formed on what to do with the high school, and we are actually still in that process of discovery on what to do with the high school and whether or not the town wants to acquire it from the school system.
Mm. So an issue of real estate as well, not just about the school itself. Pat, lastly, how has Rochester, in your eyes, fostered a sense of community despite the lack of a middle and high school? Has that been a challenge, or have other institutions kind of come in to fill that gap?
It has been a challenge. Of course, during this past 5 years, we also had a pandemic.
Sure.
So it's hard to see and determine exactly what affected the town more. But along with the ARPA funds that were given to our community, we were able to distribute a good chunk of those funds towards reinventing ourselves, and I'd like to think that we're still in the process of reinventing Rochester. We have a mountain bike trail system that is being developed that is really awesome, and our recreation facilities, hiking and biking and, you know, just cross-country skiing everywhere around here. We have really reinvented ourselves as a nice recreational town, and we are just surrounded by so much beauty that we do have a lot of people that would like to come here and like to move here as well.
Well, that's Pat Harvey, a select board member in the town of Rochester, where their middle and high school closed back in 2018. Pat, thanks so much for telling us about your community.
Oh, my pleasure.
State Representative Rebecca Holcomb, one thing I keep thinking about in this conversation, first hearing about Wyndham and then Rochester, some of the other communities we've discussed, is what an individual situation each of these schools presents. And I'm wondering, as a state representative, what the challenges are in trying to figure out a way to lower property taxes, keep school spending in check on a statewide level when each school is so unique and is part of its own unique community. Does that make sense?
Yes and no. I mean, I do think it's true, but we're all subject to the laws of gravity, right?
Yeah.
And as a consultant who once worked for the state said, the thing that's exceptional about Vermont is our belief in our own exceptionality. And, you know, when that school closed, I remember I visited it. It's a wonderful...
Rochester's?
Yes. It's a beautiful community, and they had one student left in their high school. And, you know, as John said, there's a point at which it's not fair to that child to make them be there if they're the only child left in the high school. And I really applaud the town and Pat for all the work they're doing to think proactively. The legislature's given tools to some communities, and some have used them. I mean, in one of my districts, Thetford, the community chose to preserve scale by designating the local historical academy as their public school for the purpose of tuitioning. That means every child, no matter where you go in that community, knows that they will continue with their next-door neighbor to that school. And it really is the hub of the community. And school districts have that option if they're worried about that fracturing and that fragmenting of their community as kids go in different directions. They can target those kids. They can work with the schools around them to designate them as their public schools. And that maintains that tie. In other communities, it also preserves scale. And if you are, you heard her say that when she went to Middlebury, her grandchildren felt they had more options. That's what we see. You know, and I remember hearing from a child whose parents had reached out to me when I was secretary. It was a boy, and there were no boys within two grades either direction. And all he wanted to do was play kickball at recess. And there are times when the school really may not be able to meet all the needs of all the children. And, you know, I think, John, you said 50. Sometimes it feels like it's 100, where you have to be big enough to make sure that there's a place and a friend and enough diversity of teaching faculty for those students to really feel like that they have a place there. Mm-hmm. And so these are really, really hard conversations. People are having these conversations across the state right now, not just in the two communities you've discussed, but in communities all over the state. And it's really about, if we truly believe that that schools are where we learn to work together. I mean, to me, it's the last real institution, the democratic institution, that we as Vermonters work with our neighbors to figure out what our future is. If you really believe that, if this is where you develop that muscle, these are really hard conversations, and people are having them, and they're doing the kinds of things John is talking about, looking for ways to partner to create scale. And they're also looking at how they can partner with neighbors to create scale, because that's, but you know, just one last comment, you can't have a 28-course buffet, add a bunch of new schools to that, and be surprised if your tax bills go up. There's a finite number of institutions we can support. You know, if we're paying to Canada, if we're paying to London, you can't be surprised that your tax bills are high.
Yeah. Well, John, I do want to make sure we get back to this issue of property taxes, because that's been such a big problem here in the state these last few months. What, when you're having conversations with, you know, community members, stakeholders about keeping these small schools alive and vibrant, what do you say when people come to you and are like, I cannot add another $50, $100, $500 to my property tax bill, even if I love this school?
Yeah, I think it's certainly a challenge. And we saw that bear out this past spring, right, with a number of budgets that went down. You know, it was interesting, I think, disproportionately, a number of those budgets that failed were in consolidated districts, not necessarily in continued supervisory unions or independent districts. And I think, you know, one of the goals of Act 46 was to create more transparency and more accountability in the budgeting process. And I actually think we've lost that. I think people have become disconnected. And so when you have a $50+ million budget that is comprised of 8 or 9 schools in one, you know, supervisory district, I don't think people have the same association that they once had with their local school district. Certainly, I think, you know, a larger school district can have some economy of scale. We don't know what the impact of Act 46 is. It really is due for a comprehensive study to figure out whether we did achieve any kind of cost containment or savings. I don't think we will find that, maybe anecdotally in particular areas. But I do think, you know, people are very worried about their property taxes. And I think it behooves us as school leaders to be working to be as effective and efficient. And I think collaborating, working together in terms of, you know, building capacity and resources is important. And I would say, you know, the biggest challenge that schools have to face is staff. When can you make decisions to reduce staffing if possible?
Yeah. Well, speaking of staff, I want to make sure we squeeze in one more caller, sure, who I believe is a former teacher or a current teacher. Bob in Burlington is on the line. Bob, we have just about a minute left. What are your thoughts?
Okay, very quickly. So I'm a retired teacher, 78 years old, from Michigan. I've been living now 20 years in Vermont. I taught under a system that was a self-paced open lab, which I created actually in Port Huron, Michigan. And students all were in classes by themselves with the instructor being the coordinator. But my father taught starting in the 1930s in a one-room school for the first 2 years of his teaching career, where the one-room school had 30 students and they interacted with the different grade levels. So they became teachers and mentors and also themselves. But now using the internet, being able to access course material, having the administration and all those functions being held somewhere distance away, not necessary on site, and then utilizing the elementary school partially, part of the building became a senior center, like in where I grew up in Lexington, Michigan, the last years that I taught. So there are a lot of things innovatively can be brought back to the old one-room school concept, but now with the advent of the internet, and the ability to access all kinds of learning materials and utilize both teacher and students to help themselves. And that was very successful. I did that for 4.5 years on the secondary level, and then I did it for 26 years on the college level.
Oh, well, Bob, thank you so much for your years of teaching and for telling us about what was going on in Michigan. We always love hearing what's happening in other states. There's so much more to talk about on this issue of school consolidation, school closures, and the beauty of small schools here in Vermont. We'll have to save that for another day. Our guests today were John Castle, former North Country Supervisory Union Superintendent and head of the Vermont Rural Education Collaborative. John, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We are also joined by State Representative Rebecca Holcomb from Norwich and Vermont's former Secretary of Education from 2014 to 2018. Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And thanks to all the teachers out there who are taking care of our kids with humor, grace, and courage. Appreciate them.
Amen to that.